Into Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Tuesday, January 14th, 2013. This is podcast number 260. Today I'm interviewing Max Abramson, and this is a follow-up interview to my interview with him about a year ago. Unfortunately, over the course of 2 days, Max and I tried to get connected probably about six or more times, and between phone connection problems, internet connection problems, software problems, Skype problems, and eventually even the sky itself breaking loose and just dumping rain so hard that that neither of us could hear each other. It was very difficult to get a clean recording. What you're about to hear is the best I could do with the resources that were at my disposal. It's not a good audio file, and I apologize for the quality, but Max's message is so important that I felt that I really needed to get it out, even if the file itself wasn't perfect. So I hope you can get the message out of this and not be too disrupted by the horrible sound quality. Thank you very much for listening, folks. Okay, with me today is Max Abramson, and if you are a longtime listener, you will recall I interviewed Max about a year ago. He was arrested on some really kind of bizarre situation. Max, how about if you just jump right in and give us kind of an overview of what happened and what led to... Well, first off, give us kind of an idea of the local police force that you were dealing with there before your arrest even took place, so we kind of get the idea of what kind of people we're dealing with.
Well, the Seabrook Police Department is a mixed bag. They're not all bad, but, you know, they're saying every police department has one or two bad apples. Seabrook probably has about 10 or 12. And as a matter of fact, under cross-examination, there were people in the courtroom laughing at the police at how sloppy a job that they did. It's not the best police department in New England. There are certainly some police departments, and certainly I think the State Patrol is much better and much more professional than our own town police. But essentially what happened on that night is I've stated at trial was, and as I've stated probably about 50 other times, was that people had been told to leave after this party that had been set up by my housemate and a friend of his, and some of them were too drunk, some of them weren't going to leave without their friends or their family members, and going upstairs trying to get some guy out of the house who had also been told to leave. A fight broke out downstairs. I came back down and was really out of control, and it just continued to escalate and get worse and get louder, and people were hitting harder and faster and throwing each other against the walls and pounding each other's faces into the ground. So in the police photos, the jury saw, you know, the blood on the ground and how large an area it covered and the broken glass and all of that, but what they didn't see is what kind of contributed to all that and caused all of that. And during the brawl, someone grabbed me and pulled me over to the stairwell. And there was a woman coming downstairs with an upturned knife and beer bottle, threatening me. I pulled the knife and beer bottle out of her hand and decided that this was under control, and if somebody didn't do something right away, someone was likely to get stabbed or, you know, who knows what. So I ran over to the back door and I fired a round into the ground to make a loud enough noise to break up the fight. Essentially, my concern about the whole way that the police department handled it is, one, they put a lot of people in danger. danger when they finally did show up. They only showed up after about 8 or 10 minutes after being called. They lied about that on the stand, and it was proven that they did lie about it. They said they were there at the house within a minute or two, and then they changed their story, and they said, well, we were at Pauley Mill Road within a minute or two, and yet the 911 call, the one that's recorded, is more than 6.5 minutes long, and the police still aren't there by the end of the call. So essentially what the prosecutor was arguing at the time during the trial was that I would have had ample time to just call 911 and not have to do anything. And ironically, she kept out evidence that that wasn't true. She knew about attempted murder number 3, which was the woman coming outside of the house, chasing my housemate with a hatchet, screaming that she was going to kill him for calling the police. And the fact that the jury wasn't allowed to hear that is one of the issues that's up for appeal.
Hey, Max, let me try calling you right back again and see if we can drop that noise off of there. It might be easier to do it that way.
Okay, let's see how there's something I can do on this end, too. Yeah, I tried to change my phone to cut down on some of the interference.
It may not be as bad. Well, let's just jump back into it, and we'll do what we can with it.
Okay.
So now, you had in this situation, first off, you had a party at your house that was not authorized by you.
Correct.
And you had people there who you had not invited, and you had, a very violent individual with a knife and a broken bottle.
Actually,
you got another.
There were quite a few violent individuals. As a matter of fact, prosecutors are required to turn over criminal records on her witnesses, you know, during the discovery process. She did not do that. She only turned those criminal records over, and it amounted to about 200 pages of criminal records on all of these people. And she turned it over after the jury had been impaneled and sworn. So it was after the trial had already started. And her witnesses literally showed up the next day to be questioned. I literally didn't have 24 hours to go through all their criminal records before having to cross-examine people. And they were 2 attempted murder convictions, including 1 attempted murder conviction that was about 4 months before this event, witness threatening, about 2 dozen assault and battery, including assault and battery with a dangerous weapon convictions, outstanding assault and battery warrants, burglary, larceny, breaking and entering, basically every law in New Hampshire and Massachusetts seemed to have been broken by these people at least a few times, cruelty to animals, receiving stolen property, drug trafficking near a school, everything. I mean, charges I'd never even heard of, but I didn't even know were things that I didn't even know were against the law were in their criminal records. And the jury didn't get to hear about any of that because the prosecutor moved to keep all that stuff out.
Wasn't one of them a very well-known gang member also?
According to the police reports, there was a group of them found at the Mobile On the Run station after this, and one of them is the leader of a violent gang. Just the 4 of those probably have about 100 pages of violent criminal records amongst them. Seabrook police showed up at the Mobile On the Run station where they were being questioned by Salisbury police, according to the police reports. And Seabrook police told them to just let those guys go. And what's ironic is that many of them were caught shortly thereafter breaking other laws and doing drug trafficking and reckless endangerment, drunk driving, number of felonies, assault and battery on a household member, witness intimidation, you know, all the regular stuff that career criminals engage in. And the irony is that Seabrook police let all those criminals go knowing that they were violent criminals and in their own reports admitting that they had strong suspicions that they were involved in this brawl. On the stand, Officer Luperi admitted under oath that he had evidence of attempted murder against some of them and that he chose to let them all go. And I asked him, well, why didn't you file attempted murder charges against them? And he said, I don't remember. Or no, he said, I don't know. I don't know why I didn't file attempted murder charges. And I asked him again, and he said, I don't remember.
Wow.
How can you not know why you didn't file attempted murder charges? How many attempted murders are there in Seabrook every year? Not very many. So I think there's been one in the last, one actual murder maybe in the last 10 years, and one attempted murder in the last 10 years. So there was evidence of three of them during this brawl, including gang member chasing after, coming at me and trying to wrestle the gun out of my hand. And he was let go also.
Now, some people might hear this story and they might say, you didn't act exactly like a firearms instructor would teach you how to act, or you didn't act exactly this way, or you didn't act exactly that way. But having been in a number of very violent situations that come upon you suddenly, I can say that unless you're really in the situation, it's impossible for somebody who wasn't there to judge in hindsight and criticize and say, you should have done this or you should have done that. When a violent situation is happening and seconds are ticking by and there are weapons involved, whether we're talking broken glass or knives or hatchets or whatever, even just the presence of a very large, powerful, violent person is a weapon. You have to make snap decisions right on the spot, and you chose to shoot the ground rather than shoot the guy in the forehead. And somebody might criticize that and say, you should just shot the guy. Maybe. But taking a human being's life is a lot harder than the average person realizes. So your shot into the ground, though technically, according to a gun trainer, may have been a bad choice, I don't see how it could be construed as criminal when you chose not to shoot the ground rather than to pop the guy in the forehead. I don't see how that could be considered criminal, but that's what you were facing.
I was widely and publicly criticized in hindsight by all of these Monday morning quarterbacks saying, why didn't you shoot this guy when he came at you? And why didn't you shoot this other person? Why didn't you do this and why didn't you do that? And that of course was followed up by the prosecutor saying, they could have just called 911. You could have just called 911, which is absolutely absurd. And I objected during the trial. I said that's not supported by evidence, and that's contrary to evidence. But because it was closing arguments, it was allowed. So the jury may have made the decision that, in hindsight, you could have just called 911, but yet at the same time, all of the witnesses are denying that was ever really a realistic option. There's also an element of law when a prosecutor is trying to argue that, you could have done something else, that they have to prove it, they have to provide evidence, and they have to provide notice that if they had some other reasonable option, and they also have to prove that it was a reasonable option, and it certainly wasn't in that circumstance. That really was a life and death emergency. And you say the seconds are ticking by, but when the adrenaline is going and people are frantic and people are grabbing you for help, the seconds seem to drag on. When the adrenaline is going, you really have to get to the point right then and there, or someone's going to forget.
And we're having a lot of hold on a second. We're having a lot of interference on the call, but we're going to try to push through it because we've had, three or four attempts to do this interview, and we've had everything from technical problems with Skype and software to the actual sky breaking open and stopping us. So we're gonna try to press through this and get the story out there. So, Max, you went through all the nonsense of the trial and all the theater that the state provides for us in these situations when they're supposedly seeking justice. And what was the final outcome of all that?
Well, the judge threw out – I made a halftime motion to have all of the indictments thrown out. Three of the indictments were thrown out at halftime because of complete absence of evidence. There was absolutely nothing to sustain them. The jury then threw out four more of the indictments. It's unusual. Let me put it this way. It's unusual for them to prosecute someone for acting in self-defense. It's even more unusual for them to prosecute someone for using non-deadly force in self-defense. But it's absolutely unheard of to prosecute someone for using non-deadly force in defense of others. In fact, I've been going through case law over the last year or so looking for cases dealing with self-defense, and I haven't been able to find a single case where someone has been prosecuted for using non-deadly force in defense of other people. This may very well be the first in New Hampshire history, and it could be the first appealed case ever where someone is using non-deadly force in defense of other people and being prosecuted for doing so, especially when there's so much independent evidence and there's so much evidence admitted by the state's witnesses, including the police, of evidence of people being put in real danger. The reason that I'm appealing it is not just to appeal the 200 hours of community service, which I've already completed. The reason is to prevent this precedent from being set and prevent this trend from being set where they, where gun owners and homeowners are confronted with this terrible situation where people are in danger and you use a firearm to prevent a crime from happening, that you could be the one prosecuted. And I'm just hoping that people won't hesitate if they see other people in danger or worse, walk away from the situation and let someone possibly get killed where there's an opportunity to prevent violence.
Let's put this into a different setting. Let's say a bunch of the circumstances were different. Let's say there's a father asleep in his bedroom, and let's say his daughter has invited a friend over without his knowledge, and so they're the daughter and the friend are in the let's say they're in the living room of the house, and it's the middle of the night, and there's some kind of a ruckus, and a friend of the daughter has also joined the group and is now in the process of harming or possibly even worse harming the daughter in some way, and the father wakes up in the middle of the night to this ruckus, comes downstairs, finds the person assaulting his daughter, and he's faced with this same choice, and he decides to discharge his firearm in a safe manner that doesn't necessarily kill anybody. This is, other than the fluff around the edge and other than the the issues that don't really matter on the substance, this would be the same kind of a situation, and where they would prosecute the father for discharging his firearm without actually killing the assailant.
Right. Well, and that's the same principle. The difference is, I think that most people would be willing to risk prosecution to protect a family member. Certainly, most people would be willing to risk prosecution rather than become a crime statistic themselves. The difference between the right to self-defense and the right to defense of others, especially if it's defense of other people you're not related to, and even defense of other people you may not know, is that instead of it being, the founding fathers viewed the idea of a right. On one hand, you have some rights that are liberties or privileges or freedoms, and on the other hand, you have other rights like the right to vote, and the right to keep and bear arms that are more of like a duty, a civic duty that you have. When you recognize that other people are in danger, there's a duty or a right to do something to prevent that danger. So I don't think there's any question in my mind. If you encounter an emergency that's immediate, if you see an assailant coming after your daughter or even a complete stranger, I think that you have some kind of implied duty as a citizen, as part of the social compact that we live in a republic, to take quick action to protect other people from being harmed. Just the idea that more and more prosecutors are choosing to not prevent crime, but seeming to protect the criminals, not just making sweetheart plea deals with criminals when they commit violent crimes, but going after private citizens who act in an emergency to prevent a crime from occurring, even if it's just a trespass or theft. They're using non-deadly force a law in New Hampshire states that you have the right to use non-deadly force. The difference between deadly force and non-deadly force with a firearm is deadly force is purposefully firing at someone or at a vehicle that's known to be occupied. But if you're using non-deadly force to prevent the commission of a crime, I can't see that being the criminal intent. What they're looking at with felony reckless conduct, what the general court, the state legislature is looking at for felony reckless conduct with a firearm, the examples they use are things like going into a bank or a liquor store or a crowded building and shooting up the place. That's what they mean by felony reckless conduct, not discharging around into your backyard.
So now you ended up with 200 hours of community service, and were there any other punishment on that?
Yeah, there's everything else was suspended except for a $500 fine, and the fine I filed a motion with the court to convert that to community service, and the court went along with that. So it ended up being 262 hours altogether. I'm over 200 right now, but. If I fill out a few more forms and do a little bit more work, I'll be up beyond the 262 before it's time for appeal. So there won't actually be a sentence to appeal. It'll be just a matter of principle that a homeowner has a right in the sense of a duty to protect the people in his home rather than, you know, some of the people who are in prison who are, some of them are just trying to get off on a technicality of some kind.
Were you ever offered a plea in this situation?
Yeah, but the plea was two felonies and 6 months and I think something like 5 years of suspended sentences. And even though that seemed light at the time compared with the theoretical possibility of 48 years, which is the maximum what you could get if a jury came back with guilty verdicts on all 8 indictments. It was the principle that the prosecutor and the police knew that I hadn't done anything illegal. The police admitted on the stand that they didn't have any evidence at the time that they filed charges, that I had. They admitted that they didn't have any evidence that I had done anything illegal. They admitted that they didn't have evidence that I placed anyone in danger. And if you look at their police reports, over and over again, talking to witnesses, they admit that the witnesses said that I was firing around into the backyard to break up a fight, get people out of the house. And just the fact that, you know, you're going through discovery and you're seeing over and over and over and over again that witnesses are complaining, how come you're going after Max? How come you're going after the homeowner? How come you're targeting him? What's the big deal? And essentially the admissions by the police, not an out-and-out admission that it was retaliation, but that they made it as obvious as they possibly could without coming right out and saying it. Finally, at the trial itself, the prosecutor asked a number of questions and made a number of statements where it was kind of obvious that it was just pure retaliation. It had absolutely nothing to do with protecting the public at all. And in fact, I think that she really made a farce of the whole thing. I don't think that she did a good job, and I think that it was really more to put on a big show trial. And it didn't look like there was really an effort to actually prove anything. That what they were doing was more, you know, trying to ruin some elected officials' political chances by throwing a whole bunch of felony charges and seeing what stuck. Rather than, you know, putting on the dog and pony show, rather than showing that there was someone in the backyard to be in danger. All the witnesses denied that there was anyone in the backyard.
And we should clarify that point for our listeners, too, that you you had been heavily involved in politics locally for a while, and they had a motive to single you out and treat you this way.
Well, and more to the point that it was pretty well admitted to. There were some denials by police officers, but that they knew what their own, you know, pay was and what their overtime rate was. And I was asking questions, well, you've got 6 or 8 Seabrook pops in the back of the room. You've got a third of the police department sitting there in the back of the courtroom, all on overtime. What's their overtime rate? You know, and the cop would say, "Well, I don't know." And I would say, "Well, what's your overtime rate?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, how much do you get paid?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. Their police budget is three times as large as any other town our size. There's no other town with fewer than 10,000 people that has the kind of budget that they have. If you count the stuff that's off budget and the town manager's budget, the school district's budget, their total budget goes to $4 million. So they have an outrageous budget. And serving on the budget committee, I kept asking, well, you know, what are you doing with all this money? And why do you have all these complaints that you're not responding to calls for service, or you're taking too long, or you show up and you don't do anything? Most of the complaints that I had against the police department weren't just acts of violence. They were literally doing absolutely nothing, or taking a condescending or disrespectful attitude towards people. I've had complaints against the Seabrook Police Department ranging from, you know, taking payoffs from drug dealers on South Main Street to sexual assault to beating up a number of young people, especially teenagers, targeting people's families. There are the 13 prominent families in Seabrook. Some of them don't get along, and some of them have people who are on the police department, and sometimes there are feuds within families. And so if they can get one or two of theirs onto the police department, they can target somebody else's family and file bogus charges against someone and harass someone and retaliate against a whole family by going after their high school and college age kids. And this has been going on for decades in Seabrook. And instead of people sticking together, people really fight and feud. And the police department, I think, has really become a tool for, you know, one group of families to target another group of families, or people who criticize the fact that that's going on become targets themselves. I had a couple of witnesses who wouldn't show up for trial because they had high school and college age kids now, and they don't want their kids becoming the victims of retaliation, harassment, false charges, being pulled over every time they drive home. Some of the things that Seabrook PD is famous for.
And what they did with you is kind of standard operating procedure, in the sense that they snatched you up, they hit you with as many indictments as they could possibly come up with, and when that comes to a jury trial, as unfortunate as this is, it's really true that when a jury sees somebody with, you know, 10 or 15 or 25 different indictments, they have a tendency right off the bat to think, well, if there's this many indictments, he's got to have done something wrong.
Yeah, and that's one of the tricks that prosecutors are using. Jim Reams is the Rockingham County attorney, and he's in charge of something like 22 different attorneys. His entire staff is a monster staff. It's like 40 people altogether. It's the largest in the entire state by far. Years and years ago, there were, you know, I think it was, there was the county attorney when he started, and then there was Jim Reams, he was an assistant attorney, and then there was one or two staff members. You know, years and years ago, there may have been, you know, four or five people in the entire county attorney's office. Now there are 40. And he's boasting that he has, number one, that he's gotten his budget down, and number two, he's boasting that he has something like an 85% conviction rate. And what they don't show is that they have an 85% conviction rate because they throw so many indictments against people that something invariably sticks, even when they're going after people where there's very little evidence or no evidence, or they're going after them with vague charges that are like reckless conduct, which is, or criminal threatening, which is impossible to defend against. The worst statutes in law are in Chapter 631. Reckless conduct is 631 Section 3, criminal threatening, which is also people, you know, discharge a firearm in self-defense. They throw 631 Section 4, which is criminal threatening, or the worst, probably the worst statute in law is 631 Section 6, which is if you have somebody who's been shot and you tend to their wounds and you don't report it to law enforcement, you're guilty of a misdemeanor and you can go to jail for a year for doing it. So what a lot of doctors have done is if they suspect a crime, if they're not in the hospital at the time, if somebody's got a gunshot wound, they just won't tend to the wound. They'll let the person bleed to death because there's a statute that says, you know, if you treat someone's wound and don't report it immediately, then you're guilty of a crime. You're guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. But if you don't treat the injury, you're not guilty of anything.
Wow.
So you have this entire section in the criminal code, some of the worst, vaguest, most easily misused laws in the books. And Rockingham County Attorney's Office likes to open up RSA 631 and 632 and just throw the book at people. Those two chapters, 632A, those chapters are the worst written. There's too much vagueness. If you rub someone's back, you give someone a back rub, if that person is under 16, you could potentially, you know, the prosecutor could argue that you're giving them a back rub not to help loosen up their back muscles, but you're doing it to cause arousal or something like that, and that becomes felony sexual assault, some charge like that. Some of these statutes are written so vaguely that it gives prosecutors a blank check, so they get a really vaguely written indictment from the grand jury or a whole group of them, and then they'll take the matter to court, and they'll just, when they don't get the evidence they want, then they'll just argue. I mean, they argue on opening, they argue a different theory on closing, and that's how they get a lot of people who are literally not doing anything illegal, and people are getting convicted. And the state Supreme Court is upholding a lot of those convictions, even though there really isn't any evidence of criminal wrongdoing. It would be one thing if the cases were really thin and there weren't that much evidence and they were sustaining convictions, but when there's absolutely no evidence of wrongdoing and the state Supreme Court is still sustaining those convictions, then there's something really wrong.
One of the tricks that I've seen happen, specifically I've watched this happen in a couple other states that I know of, is that they pile up enough accusations that the person ends up saying, they'll actually tell the person this. They'll pull them off into a room and threaten them and tell them, look, you may be able to beat 6 or 8 or 9 of these charges, but if we can make this one felony, let's just say it's a felony sex charge, if we can make that felony sex charge stick, your life is ruined. You'll never be able to own a gun again. You'll never be able to, live near a school or live near a public park, and they'll threaten them with one of these really heinous things like that, and they'll get a lesser they'll get them to pull a plea bargain to a lesser thing that's still a felon and that still causes them to never be able to own a gun for self-defense again. And in this way, you know, right now there's a lot of talk about gun control, but in this way, a very nasty form of gun control has been actively pursued by prosecutors for a long time now.
Yep, and I read a statistic somewhere that said 8% of America's adult working population, in other words, between 18 and 65, now have felonies on their record. A lot of those people could get them annulled if they would travel back to the original state and file some court forms and hire an attorney to do all of this. But throwing more and more and more felony charges at people, it's gotten to be such a concern that our legislators in New Hampshire, at least, are talking about it and now wanting to go back through the criminal code and convert some felonies back down to misdemeanors, at least, which would be a step in the right direction. But there's no question it's a way that prosecutors can get convictions without evidence. And Innocence Project has exonerated their 302nd person, I think, just last week. And yet what they found is 80-some-odd percent of the time, people are confessing under pressure or taking plea bargains for crimes that they didn't commit. And then when the DNA evidence finally shows up, you know, they've served 10, 15, 20 years, some people 25 years. This man, I forget his name, Benny Stalker, just spent 25 years in prison for a rape that he did not commit. And he spent the last 10 or 12 years in prison. They found DNA evidence proving he was innocent back in the year 2000. He just got released 12 years later. So half the time that he spent in prison was just because the prosecutors refused to acknowledge the DNA evidence that proved that he was innocent. Most of the fight that Innocence Project has had to do with cases like that is essentially get the courts to order people released. Likewise, there's a man in Virginia who's serving time for rape, and the DNA evidence has proved that he's innocent, and yet they're still insisting that he spend time in prison for a crime that they know that he didn't commit. John Stossel did a documentary a couple of years ago that showed prosecutors admitting on national television that they knew the person they were prosecuting was innocent all along, and they went forward with the prosecution anyway, and in some cases still got convictions against those people. And it's become such a monumental problem that almost half the cases that the New Hampshire State Supreme Court has thrown out on appeal are cases where there was absolutely no evidence, where there was no evidence of criminal wrongdoing by people. It's about 5% of the jury convictions are being thrown out because there's a complete absence of evidence.
I'll put a link in today's show notes about that lead over to the Innocence Project, because I think there's a lot of information there that people can go over there and learn about what they're doing. But that's really important work that they're doing.
And it's something I've donated to, and I've written some letters to the editor, and I've put the link in and asked people to donate it. When you get someone exonerated, the cost of the DNA test is frequently only a few hundred dollars, you know, for $800. But then, of course, on top of that, you have all of the attorneys you have to hire to work full-time to continuously file the forms and stay on these prosecutors and stay on the courts to get them to do something. And you have a lot of people who have been exonerated by evidence, and yet they're still sitting in prison just because the court system is so slow. It sometimes takes 10 or 12 years to get someone out once they've been proven innocent.
I think there's this general belief that after a person goes through all of this nonsense and they've spent maybe years in prison, that somehow they've hit the lottery, they get out and they get a bunch of money. There are a few rare cases where somebody's given $1 million or $10 million or whatever, but I think anybody who's actually spent any real time in prison would probably tell you that spending 10 or 15 or 20 years in prison then getting out and being handed $10 million is not the lottery. You haven't won. That's not, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't pay for that. You've lost something that just a pile of cash is not going to bring back to you.
Well, and on top of that, I mean, it needs to come directly out of the prosecutor or the DA's office. You know, having the taxpayer pay for that, I think is crazy. Yes, you can say, well, it's juries who are convicting on thin evidence. Almost all of the cases, when they've looked back on them, the evidence where people have been wrongly convicted, the evidence was thin. So if you're ever serving on a jury and you don't have any corroboration for something, the evidence is circumstantial, or some bit of hearsay that was allowed in that shouldn't have been allowed in, or it's evidence that either doesn't corroborate or it just doesn't quite match the prosecutor's opening statements. You know, they'll throw some really heinous charges and accusations against someone, but just acquit. If there are any doubts in your mind about anything, just acquit. It never hurts to acquit someone unless it's, you know, somebody who's, you know, murdered somebody or something like that. The vast majority of people who come through are people involved in a simple fight. They're sex charges that are blown completely out of proportion. tiny percentage of people who are repeat violent offenders. And if they've actually victimized someone, then there's someone that's going to come forward and say that they were victimized, that they were stabbed or raped or that something terrible happened to them. If there's no victim or you're struggling to find, you know, figure out who's been victimized and no one says that they've been victimized, then you have a right, if you're serving on a jury, just to acquit. The evidence is thin, you really should acquit anyway. If there's only one accuser, you absolutely shouldn't. With very rare exceptions, you should never convict someone with only one witness against them, where it's just a he said, she said case.
That's actually a biblical principle stated in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, that all things should be in the mouth of two or more witnesses in order to get a conviction. That was one of the reasons that it's been stated that Jesus' trial was illegitimate, because the witnesses their stories didn't match, and there was no actual victim to the crimes.
Do you know what passage that is, the corroboration?
I used to know that by heart, but I can't recall right now.
That's a good one. That's a good one for a letter to the editor. As soon as I find that, I'll probably write something up. But the problem in my trial was that everything that the prosecutor stated on opening was denied by all of the witnesses and the photos and the 911 recording and the police. You know, everything that she was trying to wedge out of there, she just got in there with a crowbar and tried to get people to say that it was too dark for me to see. And you have 10 out of 10 witnesses saying that, no, it's outside lights were on and the moon was out and you can plainly see the ground just fine. She was trying to argue that there was someone out there, or could have been someone out there, and you have several witnesses absolutely saying, no, there definitely wasn't anyone out there, and trying to play down the fight, and the witnesses were admitting that the fight was actually really bad. You have three witnesses looking up the stairwell, seeing the blonde woman coming down with the upturned knife, a hostile look on her face, threatening to harm or kill people. And the prosecutor is trying to play that down and say, well, she doesn't have the knife in her hand anymore. You know, the kind of pressure that they put on juries to convict people with just the way the procedure runs. And if you act in self-defense, the news media is going to come after you and paint you as a drunk hooligan who's firing rounds into the ceiling, and some vigilante taking the law into your own hands, and they're going to do everything that they possibly can to paint you as a nutcase, even when the jurors themselves are seeing that that's just not the case. And in fact, the jury saw it at the jury view. They actually saw the house that I'm in right now where the fight occurred. And, you know, they saw me and they saw how professional I was at the trial, and they saw how they saw a few of the criminals brought up as witnesses in the trial, and the contrast was pretty stark, and it also garnered some laughter. I really didn't think that any reasonable person could come up with a conviction based on that. And to take a statute that is sold to legislators on the argument that they're only going to use this to prosecute people who are robbing a liquor store and shooting up the place and leaving broken glass and liquor running everywhere and possibly shooting someone. But they're only going to use the reckless conduct statute to go after people who shoot up a bank or an apartment building. And to then have all of these cases where people do nothing more than draw their weapon. Sometimes they don't even fire their weapon and they get prosecuted for felony reckless conduct with a firearm. And to see how the statutes are twisted around and ignored sometimes by the state Supreme Court, ignored by prosecutors, and to have it sold one way to the legislators and then have something sold a different way to jurors, when it's so obvious that so many of these kind of big government activist prosecutors like Jim Reams are going after people deliberately if they act in self-defense, or worse, if they speak up against police corruption.
And I might say, too, that when it comes time for elections or when it comes time to, you know, for campaign donations, they have the honor of telling how tough they are on crime and how great their conviction rate is and all this kind of thing. And it there's a large segment of the population that hears that side of the story, and they think, oh, this guy's tough on crime. This guy's keeping us safe. When in fact, they're doing just the opposite. They're actually making people less safe with this behavior.
Absolutely. The Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm. You know, first do no damage. Don't endanger people with the criminal justice system. As John Adams said, it's far better to let 10 guilty men go free than that one innocent man should suffer, because the system exists to protect the innocent.
You know, I should mention, and this is just off the top of my head, I could be wrong on this, but I believe John Adams said that in reference to the guys who were under trial for the Boston Massacre.
That's right, and the closing argument for that was widely regarded as the best closing argument that he'd ever made. And for some people in the room, they said that was the best, most convincing closing argument that had ever been made in any trial that they had ever heard. And unfortunately, no one wrote it down. We now have, you know, audio recorders, and every single word of every bit of testimony is all written down in transcripts. But in those days, for whatever reason, his closing arguments weren't recorded. And yet we only have a couple of statements from that. And I quoted both of the statements that are remembered during that closing arguments. I think the other one was something to the effect that facts are stubborn things. Whatever may be our passions and inclinations, we cannot escape the evidence.
An interesting historical note on the Boston Massacre is that part of the argument in defense of the soldiers who did the firing, their orders were to fire over the heads of the protesters, and there are witnesses that said that they fired over the heads of the protesters. But part of the possibility of what happened was that if I recall, the governor or some other official was on the roof of the building, and all of the people who were injured, the trajectory of the bullets hit them from a downward position, which couldn't have come from the soldiers. So that was part of John Adams' argument, was that the witnesses say the soldiers fired in the air. Nobody actually saw the soldiers aim at the protesters, and there are accusations that there were people on the roof firing, so you shouldn't convict these soldiers based on the fact that they were just firing a warning shot.
Right. And there's also an argument made that John Adams used a very powerful jury nullification argument that based on self-defense or based on the orders that they were given, that these men were doing what any soldier would do if they were ordered to, you know, fire off rounds. And even if they had hit people, they were following orders and they're dealing with a violent, unruly mob. And even though the jurors were American colonists, and even though John Adams was famous for defending colonists against British prosecutors, amazingly, the jury came back with what was probably the best verdict that they could. I think it was a manslaughter conviction for the commanding officer. So it was, that's a famous one, and that's definitely one worth studying. But you brought up the issue of elections. I was sitting at the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire State Convention, not State Convention, but we had the big planning meeting before the election, and trying to get as many people to run for offices that they were qualified for as we could. And somebody joked that I run against Jim Reams. And ironically, because I'd filed a motion for continuance on the sentencing hearing, that gave me a little technicality with a short window to put my name in for one last elective office. And I'm famous for running for local office, and you know, the saying, a vote for Max is for less taxes. And I put my name in for Rockingham County Attorney and ran against Jim Reams. And it became a big news story that was covered all the way up and down the seacoast. And, of course, they said the title of the story in the Hampton Union was Convicted Felon Runs Against Jim Reams. And the great thing about that was that the public finally got to see a lot of the evidence that was kept out of the case that was absolutely critical to the decision, and the jurors didn't get to hear about the hatchet, the machete, the other potential weapons, chainsaw, all the potential weapons that were there, the criminal records of some of these people, and the fact that some of them have gone back out and really victimized a lot of other people. So Jim Reams finally caught a lot of flack for that, and so much so that in a really tight three-way race, he almost lost his re-election bid. There was a newcomer who ran as a Democrat and was not very well known, and because I pulled something like 8% of the vote off, and because of the negative publicity, negative press, Jim Reams almost lost the race. I think he got less than 50% of the vote countywide.
Wow.
For the first time. And it's possible that next time, when he puts his name in again, there will be even more press coverage for this. I was also able to get in some of the victimless crimes that his office has gone after. The fact that he's had two or three of his prosecutors forced to resign because of their own criminal actions. They had a couple of DUIs and I think one other crime that forced two or three of the prosecutors to resign from office. And that was the only reason that his budget was cut at all, because they've had so many criminal problems and ethical problems, and they've been forced to have some people resign. But the victimless crimes, the pot smokers, the nonviolent offenders who were being prosecuted, gun owners, people using medical marijuana, those issues came up. People driving with a suspended license being prosecuted. People involved in a simple fight being prosecuted, having charges elevated by an order of magnitude beyond where they should have been based on the actual evidence. And it was good to see that he was finally being questioned on some of these things that he's probably never been questioned on. He was asked, well, isn't it true that Mr. Abramson didn't get all this evidence in, and this was a self-defense case, and shouldn't the jury have heard about that? And Reams' response is just, well, he's been convicted.
And wow.
That was all he could come back. That was all he could come back with. He said, well, the jury heard everything, and of course they didn't, and that's kind of become the talk of the town. And now Jim Reams is being looked at by self-defense advocates and gun owners in New Hampshire who are not so sure that they're going to be backing him in 2014 when he's up again.
That's a pretty amazing story. So what's do you have anything planned for the future, or what are you going to be up to in the future?
Well, as a matter of fact, some of the people high up in the police union have been fighting dash cams in Seabrook for years and years. They absolutely refused to install them. And dash cam video would have captured a lot of evidence that was lost in this case. And we could have gotten recordings of what all of the witnesses said, audio recordings. We could have gotten the video recording showing the woman chasing my housemate with a hatchet. We could have seen there's some evidence showing that police officers lied on the stand about some important relevant facts and issues, and the evidence is pretty strong that they did commit perjury. But if we had dash cam video, it would have caught a lot more of it. We would have caught video of the blonde woman chasing my housemate with a hatchet, screaming that she was going to kill him for calling the police. And that was important because the prosecutor was arguing that by this point it was all completely safe and there was no reason for firing off a weapon. You know, in between attempted murders 1, 2, and 3, she said that it was completely safe and that there was no reason to do anything. But I think the dash cam petition has a lot of public support, and I think that if it passes, it's going to be a difficult issue for those police officers who are allegedly taking payoffs from drug dealers, because they could be catching themselves on video doing it. They could be catching themselves on video beating up young people. Officer Hersey slammed some kid into the police cruiser a couple of weeks before my trial and broke a couple of his teeth. There have been a lot of allegations of violence by Seabrook cops, and when it's caught on video, a lot of jurors don't believe police anymore. They don't believe witnesses anymore. But when dash cam video comes out and people see it from one or two or three different angles, even the judges who tend to believe whatever the police say are forced to look at the video and kind of acquit people who are wrongly accused by police officers.
Well, we've almost run out of time, Max, but I want to let you know that, if I ever get up there and spend very much time in New Hampshire, I definitely want to look you up, because anybody who has parties where there's machetes and axes and knives and firing of pistols and fistfights, man, I want to be there. That sounds like my kind of party.
Can you come up to the Freedom Expo? It's at Exeter Town Hall. It's free to get in. That's going to be on Saturday, April 27th from 10 to 6 p.m., and it'll be all day long, and we'll have tons of vendors there and pizza and hot dogs, and we have a lot of food vendors and people who do balloon animals and things like that. A lot of different liberty groups and Second Amendment groups, and a lot of different very cool people will be coming there. We had pretty fair attendance this year for 2012. We're expecting to get at least twice that for 2013.
I saw the invitation for that, but I'm not exactly sure how that's going to fit into our schedule. We're going to be up there in February for the New Hampshire Liberty Forum, and we hope to be back for Pork Fest. So it's not impossible for us to make that one. My wife and I are looking at our schedule to see if we can actually pull that off or not.
It would definitely be great to see you there, or any of your listeners. It's all of the groups in New England, not just New Hampshire, but all over New England. A lot of liberty groups and a lot of local businesses and local farmers and musicians are coming out to show their music and show their wares and, you know, put the brochures out and sell the cop block t-shirts and things like that.
Say the dates and the name of it again.
It's all going to be Seacoast Annual Freedom Expo, and it's on Saturday, April 27th at Exeter Town Hall, which is right in the center of Exeter.
Do you think you'll be over to the Liberty Forum this year?
Yeah, we'll be at the Liberty Forum, going around to vendors, filling up spots. The tables at the Liberty Forum are something like $200 or $250, depending on what level of sponsorship you do. For a Freedom Expo at Liberty Forum, or for the one-day Freedom Expo, it'll be $35 a table. So it's a much better deal. It targets a completely different audience, and it's free to get in, so it brings in a completely different crowd than the Liberty Forum. It's a much more laid-back event. I think Freedom Expo is more of like a New England-centered event rather than Liberty Forum, which I think is kind of meant to be a national type of event, more as a national weekend-long event, whereas Freedom Expo, we just do it as a one-day thing.
Well, I'll definitely look for you there and see if we can't spend a little time together and at least say hi.
Sure.
Well, thanks for coming on the show with me, Max. I'm sorry about us having so many troubles trying to get this recorded, and hopefully I'll be able to clean up the audio enough that it'll be, that people can listen to it. But thanks for coming on the show with me anyway.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Take care of yourself, Max.
Yeah, you too.
Well, so that was the interview with Max Abramson, and I apologize about the sound quality. That was the best that we could come up with. I hope you were able to stick with it all the way to the end, and be sure and get over to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission, and thank you again for listening today. Thank you very much. Goodbye.